So you were at Uber during the delete Uber hashtag campaign. How'd that make you feel?
Well, it was a bit bewildering. Yeah, it was just a bit strange, you know, because the whole thing was built on a faulty premise, and it was like a match that was lit and you couldn't put it out. And we just felt like it wasn't really any kind of form of justice, because the actions that certain people in the company had taken were just being misinterpreted.
That was Chris Saad, the former head of product for the developer platform at Uber. The strike he's referring to is a taxi strike at airports that happened in 2017 as a reaction to a new federal immigration ruling. Now, beyond surge pricing, what exacerbated the situation was that the algorithm missed the human and political side of the situation. As a result, rather than avoided being a price gouger, the company was now viewed as a strike breaker as Ubers flocked to airports. Of course, Uber is just one example. The recent backlash we've seen against Facebook in the wake of the Cambridge Analytica scandal is another important reminder of what can happen when people feel that their trust has been violated. And that's the key word here, trust. Fundamentally, that's what so many consumer backlashes boil down to. Now, there's a lot here, but we believe consumers will trust companies that aren't doing things that might harm them or expose things they don't want exposed. And they often entrust their personal data to those companies. When it works, the result is better outcomes for everyone. When it doesn't, things start to go awry. Today on the show, I'm delighted to be joined by Chris Saad to talk about data rights and data portability, what can happen when people perceive that their trust has been violated, and what companies can do to avoid such situations in the first place. I should mention that we invited Chris to the show because of his thought-provoking Medium post advising people not to delete Facebook because of the Cambridge Analytica scandal. If you haven't seen it, it's worth a read, and you can find a link to it in our show notes. All right, with that, let's get on with the show. I'm John Pryle. Welcome to the Impact Podcast. Chris, it's great to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
And tell us a bit about yourself.
Oh, I'm a serial entrepreneur. I built and ran a series of companies and products and ecosystems. I think most notably and most recently was I was the head of product for the developer platform at Uber.
So, Chris, I consider myself a pretty cautious guy, maybe an overly cautious guy. And I've made some decisions on how I work with a lot of companies. So I'm using DuckDuckGo as my search engine. Going back to what seems like forever, I've never really taken the log on with Facebook option. And as a piece of must be ancient history now, I wouldn't sign up for whether, I don't remember if it was Spotify or Pandora, I can't remember which one, but at the time, the only option to sign up was via Facebook. So do you think I'm nuts?
Well, like let's go back in time a little bit to where all this came from. I think it's probably important. So one thing I didn't mention when I was talking about my bio is I was one of the co-creators of this thing called the Data Portability Project. And way back in, you know, 2006, 2007, you know, these social networks were coming up through the world and becoming very important. And, you know, every week there was a new social network and there was a new social app and a new behavior that we were all going to be, you know, it was going to be the next hot thing. And at the time, it was impossible. You had to start again every time you signed up to one of these services. You had to upload your photo and your name and your friends list and all this kind of stuff. And a group of us got together and thought, well, this is A, redundant, and B, as some of these gain a lot of power, they're going to gain, or a lot of data, they're going to gain a lot of power. And so we started advocating for a thing called data portability, the ability for you to use data from one social network or one application and port it to another in real time.
Now that's log on and personal data. Is that similar to like OAuth? I had a colleague doing a startup many years ago and she was using OAuth.
Yeah. So what's important to point out is that there were existing efforts to do bits of this. There was OAuth for authentication. There was OpenID for the identity piece. There was OPML and RSS for feed reading and news. And there was, you know, XMPP for chat. So that these technology efforts were already in progress and some really brilliant people were working on them. But there was a lack of cohesive message, a narrative that the media and the mainstream could understand. And so, yes, OAuth is part of this and became very popular, I won't say as a result of data portability, but through that period and connect with Facebook and Twitter ID and Google Takeout and all of these things were, let's call it, influenced by the data portability project and its efforts.
Did they succeed? Obviously, something succeeded in terms of log on with Facebook. Obviously, I think they delivered an important message. What do you think happened? Do you think they succeeded?
I think there was what I would call a partial success. I think data portability would have been better termed data interoperability. So the ability where there's open standards coming out of each of these applications and social networks so that you didn't have to code defensively against each of them. You didn't have to implement Facebook Connect. The idea was that you should be able to implement almost like delegated identity and be able to log in with any third-party provider. And that was the dream. It was meant to be completely interoperable. What we ended up with was a series of proprietary ways to connect to Facebook and to Twitter and to Google. Now, there was a mechanism in there that was pretty open standard, like OAuth, although it never got implemented quite right everywhere. But the way the data was encapsulated and transported and the API calls never got standardized. So we have right now what I would call partial data portability without the interoperability part.
Now, just to be very clear here, there's all these elements you talked about from authentication and identification, log on. So there's a little bit of me getting into a system, and there's no point being redundant in every app doing it differently billing it to share. But as we record this podcast, yeah, we're kind of in GDPR launch week as well. That's a different amount of data. So can you help me parse kind of the front end who I am data versus the back end, maybe the data that a company is collecting about me?
Yeah, for data portability, we were mostly interested in the identity data, the profile data, the friends data, the friend graph. But it was really it didn't really differentiate. It didn't really talk specifically about, you know, your browsing history data or what have you versus your front end profile data. The idea was that any of this data could and should perhaps be portable at the behest of the user request, and so we didn't parse that out too much, even though most people were more interested in the profile data in the conversation. Where now it comes to GDPR, what's really interesting is that the phrase data portability is used in the law and is a core tenet of the law. I'm not an expert on the law, but my understanding is that it's being used in a slightly different way, which is the ability to offline take your data and port it out, kind of like you port your phone number from one carrier to another. It's a thing you do sometimes versus a thing you do, you know, on a regular basis in real time.
I've been stunned with the amount of terms and condition updates I've been getting this week from almost every vendor, they don't say GDPR much, but they say, oh, we've got new terms and conditions and here's what's going on. So if data portability is so important, and obviously it critically is, do you still see too many walled gardens out there? And am I like 10 years in the past, and I'm thinking that a Google search doesn't get access to Facebook data? Does that matter anymore? Or do we have apps kind of passing things between each other in a portable way? And I shouldn't be worrying about crawlers and screen scraping and the like.
Well, I mean, these are all different concepts, right? So apps passing data to each other behind the scenes in some kind of data sharing agreement that they have is a, you know, that's oftentimes about selling data or about strategic partnerships and is not in user control. It's not user centric. It's not at the behest or request of a user. That is not what data portability is about. I want to make that very clear. And that's actually not what happened with Cambridge Analytica and Facebook either. And that's why I wrote this Medium post around people complaining that Facebook is selling your data and all this data leakage. That's not actually what happened. On the other hand, there is the ability to connect with Facebook or to connect with Google. And at your request, Facebook will share your Facebook data with another app. And that's something that you ask Facebook to do, and Facebook does at your request. And it's a very user-centric thing. It's a thing that is done respecting the fact that you, if not own your data, at least have rights to what happens with your data. And then in terms of walled gardens, I would say it's a really mixed bag. Like these applications will let you use some of your data in some ways, some of the time. You know, Google will let you take it and do whatever you want with it. Facebook will let you take some of it and take it to apps they trust or at least have some kind of relationship with. And they'll let you use it for some applications, but not all applications. And now in the reaction to the delete Facebook backlash in Cambridge Analytica, of course, that's all changing again. And so my Medium post was really trying to say, take a breath, everybody. Not all data sharing is created equal. Certainly not all data sharing is evil. Some of the data sharing is actually something we fought hard to get a right to do. And some of this is actually, users need to take a responsibility for the apps they choose to share their data with. And that's not to impugn Facebook, but rather to impugn the quiz app that everybody asked Facebook to share their data with, and that they should have taken a little bit more responsibility for that.
So I want to come back to the quiz and Cambridge Analytica. I just want to close a little more on the data portability piece. Sounds like I'm not nuts that I don't want to necessarily log on with Facebook, but there's nothing wrong with it if I'm very conscious as to what I'm doing and that I'm allowing Facebook to share this data with other companies. I'm getting connections and other data gets shared. And as long as I'm, as a user, comfortable with it, that's okay. We'll get to bad behavior next, but in terms of me being a little overly paranoid, perhaps I am.
No, you're not being overly paranoid. I actually don't use the Facebook login feature that often either. I use it very intentionally and with the apps that I think really need that rich data. But yeah, you're not paranoid if you're intentionally choosing to use it or not use it at the right time. And there's also an argument to be made that some of this user experience should change so that it's clearer to users that logging in is not necessarily sharing data. Maybe these things should be parsed out and separated. And so that may be a response to some of these things that is more reasonable. But you're not being paranoid. You're making an intentional decision, and that's perfectly fine.
And I am looking for a very clear infographic like terms and conditions, and just parsing logon information versus data collected, data exhaust that gets created. It would be nice for companies to share that. That would help us all make the decisions that we want to make, right?
Yeah, to an extent. Look, in my mind, you know, these apps and these companies haven't gone maybe far enough. But to be clear, the OAuth loop, the OAuth process, and the standard pattern for this data sharing to happen, this data portability style data sharing to happen, does include a relatively clear consensus or consent form. When you hit, you know, log in with Facebook, you're presented with a screen that says, we are going to share these three or five or seven things with the next app that is requesting this. And you don't need to dig into the terms of service. It tells you right there in a list, we're going to share your profile, your email address, your friends list, what have you. Do you consent? And you hit deny or allow. And so in many ways, this has been parsed out and put right in front of you. Now, most users just hit allow and they're now claiming, you know, some kind of betrayal of trust. Is it possible to make that screen better, easier, more symbol-based and more visual? Sure. But I think there's a certain amount of retrograde mob justice going on here.
Maybe too much angst running around here.
Yeah, I think we're all looking for people to be angry about and any action we can take in this kind of political climate.
And I do see on Chrome when I open up a new website, it says that they'd like your location, block or allow. I do see on my iOS, they want to access your camera, or they want to access the mic, or they want to access your address book. So we are probably being asked it more than we think.
Yes, that model that you just described about kind of asking for permission when and only when you need access to a particular resource is a really great model. And it's one that iOS has adopted. It's one that Android is increasingly adopting. It's one that, to be clear, Facebook and Google and Twitter and data portability was not advocating and did not adopt. So what they're doing is at the point of login, think of it analogous to at the point of installing the app on your phone, they're asking for all the permissions at once. And so perhaps that's less clear than, okay, you can just log in here. And then when we need your friends list, we'll ask for the friends list separately. And then when we need your profile picture, we'll ask for the profile picture separately. So that may be a better pattern. It may be more explicit, more clear. I just want to point out that that's not, you know, it wasn't completely nefarious before. It was perhaps just slightly suboptimal compared to what iOS was doing.
Yeah, I can see almost a little box on the bottom that says, don't ask. Sometimes something pops up as a warning, and then you get the box to say, don't ask me this again. So if I do make this connection through Facebook and it says, look, here's the things we're going to share, click here if you want me to tell you each time, or click here for yes to all kind of thing. There's ways this can evolve.
There is ways that it can evolve, but also remembering that the other end of the spectrum is just annoying the hell out of users and breaking the user experience, right? And so these companies are trying to walk that line. And you know, having been on the inside trying to walk that line and being very conscious of data portability, I can tell you it's non-trivial to do a good job.
Indeed. So let's talk about a little bit of bad behavior. So the assumption is when people were using the quiz app, they know they were giving data to the quiz creator. I think it's actually funny because I kind of keep my distance from Facebook and all these surveys that are up and, you know, what's your personality? I'd never wanted to do it just because I didn't want to. I feel like I'm wasting my time, but I see lots of people posting, oh, I'm this, I'm a cat, I'm a whatever. I don't know if they even knew they were capturing their data, but your assumption is when people were doing the quiz, they knew the quiz creator was getting data. Yes?
Well, I don't want to, you know, speak for each and every individual that was doing this, but I know that Facebook presented them with a screen that said, you know, by doing this, you are sharing your data, and delineated the list of things you're sharing. And that list included your friends list and some of the data about your friends. That has since been rolled back a little bit where you can't share as much data about your friends anymore. But yes, users were certainly said, you know, this is an action you're taking. Facebook will share your data with this third-party app. Now, probably none of them stopped to read that and look at that. And that is, you know, probably the overriding argument that critics of Facebook will be making. And another argument might be, well, that's an enormous amount of data for very little utility. But at the end of the day, when you create a utility like Facebook, you create a tool, the user has to use it well. Now, the tool can have built-in safety features, and Facebook has some of those and could possibly build more. But that is certainly something the users asked Facebook to do on their behalf.
But that friends list is interesting. And you talk about walking a fine line and what that might mean. And we'll come back. I will come back to quiz sharing the data with Cambridge Analytica, but I'd like to talk for just a couple seconds on this. There's a lot of articles lately that says, oh, Facebook must have my microphone on. They must be listening into me. There was a very cool podcast, a Reply All podcast, spent an entire episode of proving whether Facebook did or didn't listen to you on the microphone because these two women were together. And they mentioned somebody from high school 10 years ago. And then the next day, a friend request showed up for that person. And there's dozens of examples like this. And they kept saying, no, it's just once they know your friends and everything your friends knows, it's so trivial to get to that conclusion that this is the next person they should recommend, kind of thing. That friends data actually is far more rich, I should say, than a lot of other data that's collected.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the argument, well, a couple of things. There's this old story of how Target started sending, you know, prenatal vitamin recommendations to a young girl before her mother knew she was pregnant, just because of the way, you know, she was browsing around and her purchase behavior. They, you know, especially now with machine learning algorithms and, you know, lookalike algorithms, it's very, very easy to make these inferences. If you go to the same event, then you're probably going to bump into each other, and that's who Facebook recommends for you to friend next, and on and on.
Well, yeah, I think the key to the pregnancy one is there's an element of, and we use the term in our conversational business thesis, is don't be creepy. Yes, that's vague. Just sending stuff pregnancy in a physical mail, right? The U.S. Postal Service that we were sending coupons about diapers or whatever really did panic that woman's parents. So we don't want to be creepy, but we want to absolutely provide as much value as we can to our end users.
The creepy line moves. The creepy line is always moving, right? And the thing that probably marks Facebook history the most is Mark Zuckerberg's, you know, ability or willingness to press on the creepy line as hard as possible and to move it. And, you know, Facebook has been freaking people out, you know, for a long time by pressing and pressing and pressing and pushing out that creepy line. You know, one could argue that's not what society needs or wants, and one could argue, well, actually, that's kind of interesting, and it's gotten us to a different place. And so, you know, the thing I always come back to is when the telephone first came out, people thought of it as a massive privacy invasion. You know, who the hell gives other people the right to ring a bell in your home? That is hugely invasive, right? And so, whenever I find myself or other people pressing it back against the future, I always think back to people who would complain about the telephone and the TV, and I just think to myself, is there a chance that I am going to be looked back on as one of these people in 20 or 30 years? And that's something that keeps me in check in terms of my grumpy old man syndrome.
So I do want to close on Quiz. So Quiz did nothing wrong. Facebook was clear to the people what was going on. The nefarious thing that happened was that Quiz did something they should not have done, which may be difficult to capture. They took their data and then they sold it to Cambridge Analytica, correct?
That's right. So the sequence of events is there was a quiz app that was very popular. Many users gave Facebook permission, in fact, requested from Facebook that they share their personal data with the quiz app for the purposes of taking the quiz. The quiz app did nothing wrong at this point. What then happened, by the way, in the terms of service from Facebook, it states to the quiz app, you shall not resell this data to other people. The quiz app then broke that terms of service, violated Facebook's trust, and they violated the user's trust by then selling that data on to Cambridge Analytica. Now, it's almost impossible for Facebook to audit that. I don't know where you begin to try to enforce that law or that policy, except perhaps for Facebook to, you know, have a big fund for suing anybody who does this kind of thing and put a lot of teeth behind the policy, which they should do. But then Cambridge Analytica went and used that data for profiling in other wholesale ways. That was a violation of the user's trust and of Facebook's policies.
I often think about when I click on a terms and condition and it might involve agreeing to a third party, I almost want to see that terms and conditions say, and by the way, we're going to enforce that, we're going to require that anybody we work with uses the same or tighter terms and conditions. It could never get loosened. And be very explicit about that. There are third parties and these are what we're holding them to. So just another element of kind of building trust for the users.
Yes, but you know, it's turtles all the way down, right? So now we need to enforce that all the way down. Someone somewhere has to enforce. And so it's not enough to just write it down. There needs to be teeth. And so, I mean, it's fine for the quiz app to have the same terms of service, and then they may turn around and still violate, you know, their terms of service, right? So, somebody has to be policing all of this. It's very difficult. And Facebook is trying to step up to that challenge. But, you know, I would argue that we should cut them a little bit of slack while they gear up.
Sure. So I want to go a little bit on business models just a bit. And you talk, and I think it ties a little bit to them. You talk about Facebook kind of pushing the creepy line. So clearly our industry has matured. You know, we used to only worry about eyeballs. And we had an amazing pre-crash thing where people were paying money. Venture capitals were paying big money for eyeballs. At least we have more data. We've got click-throughs and dwell times and conversion rates. So from your sense and look at business models, you think we're doing better?
I think we're doing better. You know, there's the one of the things that I touch on the Medium post is that the backlash was about selling user data as a business model. And the thing is, Facebook doesn't sell user data. It never did, and it wasn't the cause of all of this problem. Now, the quiz app sold the data, but Facebook did not. What they're selling is actually user attention. That's just a fancy way of saying they're selling ads. Selling ads is a business model that is as old as, I don't know, what, radio, print, before, you know, cave paintings? How old is selling ads on the side of the walking trail, right, of the hunting trail? So, you know, we just have to be really, this is a complicated, nuanced thing. And I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with Facebook's business model. Now, there is an additional business model, which is a revolutionary, which is a charging for things. So, you know, you pay for Facebook and Facebook gives you service. And you know, it's been kind of sort of proven that most people don't want to pay for most things on the internet. And so the ad-supported model is the way to go. Now, I'd love to see Facebook introduce a paid option that just simply subsidizes Facebook for what they would have made from the ads model, the ads business. I don't see why not, why they couldn't try that out at least.
Well, newspaper, you know, we have, it's interesting. I have some magazines I actually pay for, and I see them in my news feeds. So I really don't need to pay for the magazine, but I still pay for it because I feel like I have to support them somehow, right? It is something that some of us are thinking of. Now, you mentioned that they're selling ads, though, but they're really, you mentioned they're seeking your attention. The more attention I give them, the more time they have to place ads. which explains to me, which I think is the perfect explanation, was I was very happy with Facebook as a world of my friends and family. Did not like the news feed. Don't use it. I prefer to pick where I want to get my news from. But the news feed obviously was attention and opportunity for ads. And now dating is showing up. So it used to be who controls the screen. What's the default screen? Right? Google didn't want you to leave the Google screen. So all they were giving as much answers as possible without going to another website. Is that what's happening with all? They're not just competing for attention. It's almost not strong. I want to strengthen that term somehow. They're really competing for them to own the interface to you. Is that an overstatement, perhaps?
Well, if they're not, maybe what you're trying to say is if they're not trying to own attention, they're trying to own addiction. They're trying to become, right? They're trying to become the de facto, you know, default interface to the world. And this is true of, you know, Amazon Alexa and Google Home and the Xbox and the TV and the operating system on your phone, on your PC. Absolutely. There is a platform war for attention and for addiction to be the operating system for your life, or at least slices of your life, even the car. And whoever is the gatekeeper to the functionality of that slice of your life gets to earn an enormous amount of money. The only people on the internet who have ever made any real money are those who can determine and fulfill your intention as fast and effectively as possible. And, you know, Google is an attention and intention fulfillment machine. And Facebook figured out another different way of doing that. And then, you know, the other thing to keep in mind is every time there's a new platform, there's a reshuffling of the deck. So the phone, which had replaced, you know, the desktop as the main surface area for attention, allowed Apple to overtake Microsoft and IBM clones. You know, now there's the fight for voice, and then there's the fight for the home, which is now allowing Alexa to step in and do something interesting in Google. And so these are continuous, ongoing battles between the major platform players and the upstarts. And so it's very exciting, exciting, interesting, and, you know, with consumers being the gold mine that and your consumer attention being the thing that everyone's mining for. I struggle to apply good versus evil to that. I think it's very simple in today's day and age to say, well, is this good or is it bad? Well, that kind of duality, unfortunately, doesn't exist in the world. There isn't simple answers to good versus bad. It is what it is, and we should be thoughtful about it. We should regulate it to a healthy, smart degree, and we should all also, as users, educate ourselves as well as to the implications.
That's great. So I guess I just want to wrap this up around an element of trust. What should companies and CEOs do to make sure they're focusing on keeping the trust of their users?
Yeah, so, you know, trust at its foundational level is saying you're going to do something and then doing it, right? And in this area of software, that declaration of what you're going to do is much more implicit. It's by the way you design the interface. It's by the way you set up your brand. It's kind of the social contract you set up with your users. And it's sometimes easy to misjudge the implicit social contract you've made with your users and to cross that line into breaking their trust. And of course, some companies do that intentionally and nefariously. They set up a bad pattern, or they do something underhanded. Trust is all about building a relationship for the long term. And there are always going to be people who misuse and violate trust, and they probably won't last over the long term. And it's funny, I'm not really a market, you know, purist market forces guy, but in many ways, market forces will dictate some of that. And as people get their trust violated, they will move and ebb and flow to various things. And then at the end of the day, you know, smart regulation is also essential as well. I think GDPR, the new law in the European Union, you know, there's arguments to be made whether that is smart regulation or over-regulation. I would probably argue it's probably taken a little too far, just a little. Some of the law, if taken literally, is untenable and impractical. But we're going to find that line. You know, Facebook is a company that continues to promise us that they're going to push that line. They used to push it very aggressively, you know, in their first 5, 7, 10 years. And we'll continue to be flirting with it over time. And users have voted with their feet they've shown up and they continue to use it. The main message I was trying to make with the Medium post was we should use this as a teachable moment. We should certainly be concerned, but we shouldn't pretend that we are completely blindsided here by what Facebook is doing. And we certainly shouldn't accuse them of things that they weren't doing, and which is, you know, wholesale selling our data. You know, more broadly, I think the thing that I'm most frustrated with, particularly in the US culture right now, is this sense of mob justice before all the facts are in. I mean, this kind of loss of due process and rational thinking a little bit. And that's, I think the delete Facebook incident was a great poster child for that. And in an area where I was very passionate because I was involved in the data portability project. And ultimately that's why I piped up and had something to say.
Chris Sott, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, no worries. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you like what we're doing, we'd appreciate your telling other people about the show. Better yet, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or write a review. Doing so will really help ensure that more people can find us. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the Impact Podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you go to find your podcasts.